Well, I hope you'll keep the story open before you of the woman at the well. I wonder if you've ever read Mark Twain's book, The Prince and the Pauper. It was televised a few years ago, but perhaps if you're not a family person, as you're probably not, you didn't watch it at that time. But it's the story of how Edward VI, as a young boy, had a double. Somebody looked exactly like him, but who was only a pauper, just a very poor child. And through some strange circumstance, these two boys met each other and changed places for fun, planning to change back again, but it didn't work quite as quickly or as easily as that. And the poor prince, now dressed in rags and going round as a pauper, has the terrible task of trying to say to people that he's not who he appears to be. He's mixed up with a gang of thieves. His father is one amongst this gang. And every now and then he says to people, "Look, I'm not who I appear to be. I'm the Prince of Wales. I'm the heir to the throne." And of course, you can imagine the reaction there. He's greeted with howls of derision. It's the greatest joke imaginable. If you think of that story, you can realize something of the problem, in a sense, that faced Jesus. A problem that, in an astonishingly short space of time, he solves with this woman. Between her and him, there are only a few exchanges of conversation, but at the end of it, he's able to say to her in verse 28, "I who speak to you am he," that is, "I am the Messiah." Think what her reaction would have been if he'd started off like that and tapped her on the shoulder and said, "By the way, I'm the Messiah." Howls of derision there would have been. What skill Jesus shows in speaking to this woman and in leading her on step by step. Now, I'm afraid we can't sort of study that aspect of the story in absolute detail, but it's something to look at more fully. But what I want to do is to link together two highlights of the conversation. The first one is in verse 10. Jesus answered her, "If you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, 'Give to me a drink,' you would have asked of him, and he would have given you living water." You see there, Jesus puts his finger on two things. If you knew, and two things, if only she knew them, she would act differently. Take the second one first. The second one was, who it is that's speaking to you. If you realized who I am, the person of Christ. And then the other thing, if only she knew, if you knew the gift of God. The gift of God. What it means really to have access to God and to find in him your needs, your desires, your longings fully satisfied. He describes this gift under the terms of living water. For people growing up in the East, water is a very special and exciting thing. Thirst can be one of the most agonizing things that somebody has to face in that situation. And therefore, thirst and the longing for its satisfaction became, for Jews and other peoples of the East, a picture of their longing for God, the one who alone can satisfy. And we have that Psalm 42, of which we sang the paraphrase, "As pants the heart for cooling streams when heated in the chase, so longs my soul, O God, for thee." And the gift that Christ offers is that real contact with God that will satisfy the longings of the thirsty soul. So there he introduces it in verse 10, but the same theme of these two great needs of knowing who he is, what he offers, is really implicit in the long talk that Jesus gives her towards the end of the conversation when he answers her question about worship in verse 19 and 20. The woman says to him, "Sir, I perceive you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain. You Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship." And the woman's often been accused of drawing in a red herring at that point. Jesus has just touched on rather intimate and personal details of her life. "Yes, you've had 5 husbands," he says, "and he whom you now have is not your husband." And rather wanting to get away from this uncomfortable discussion, she starts sort of bringing in questions about, well, are the Methodists right or the Anglicans? You know, are the Jews right or the Samaritans? And raises a red herring. But it isn't really a red herring. How do you get through to God? And for this Samaritan woman, the way of putting that question is to ask, well, where do you get through to God? We Samaritans say that you should do it on this mountain, Mount Gerizim. You Jews say that you should do it at Jerusalem. I wish I could get through to God, but I've never known where or how. And Jesus proceeds to give to her the final answer. And in fact, he outlines 3 types of worship. He says that true worship must be worship in spirit and in truth. But he speaks first of all about Samaritan worship, which was not even worship in truth. He speaks secondly about Jewish worship, which was worship in truth but not in spirit. Finally, he speaks about the coming Christian worship, which he is going to inaugurate, and he says that worship will be worship both in truth and in spirit. Verse 23, "The hour is coming, and now is." He is about to introduce this sort of worship. Let's look at those 3 sorts of worship. First of all, Samaritan worship, which was not even worship in truth. I wonder if you know who the Samaritans were. They're a quaint sort of throwback in the New Testament, aren't they? In fact, to understand the Samaritans, you have to go back to 722 BC. In that year, the northern tribes of Israel were carried away into captivity. And in their place, colonists were brought from Babylon to fill the gap. And the Samaritans of Jesus' day were descendants of some of the Jews who'd been left behind and of these Babylonian colonists who'd been brought in. And when those Babylonians arrived, they said to one another, "Now look, we ought to do the right and decent thing. Here we are in a strange land. We need to find out something about the God of this land and worship him." But of course they didn't really know anything about him. He'd not been revealed to them. They hadn't got the background of the history. They hadn't come through the Red Sea with Moses and had the law given to them. They hadn't been through all the things that through which Israel had learnt about God in her long history. But they did their best. They picked up a few random ideas here and there, added in a few of their own, and they ended up with a glorious concoction. And by the time Jesus was there, they were saying, "This is the right way to worship God." But see what Jesus says about them. Verse 22. "You Samaritans worship what you do not know." You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We Jews worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. Now, you see there that Jesus is laying down the great cardinal principle of worship. Worship has got to be in truth. You've got to worship God as he is, not as you would like to imagine him to be. And if you want to know what God is like, what he is, You've got to look where he has revealed himself. You can't just concoct your own ideas of him as the Samaritans had done. How many people go wrong here, don't they? Many people start off and they assume that they know what God's like. They know the way into his presence. They know what he requires. And you get people using expressions, well, like this. They say, well, I like to think of God like this. Well, perhaps you do like to think of God like that. But the point is, what is he like? And therefore, it's not surprising that when Jesus spoke to this Samaritan woman, one of the things, you see, he says to her is, if you knew who it is that's speaking to you, we must know who God is. And the only one who has revealed him, finally, is Jesus Christ, and therefore we need to know who Jesus Christ is. And so the Samaritans, you see, they didn't worship in truth. And our worship has got to be in truth, basing ourselves on what God has revealed of himself, both in the Old Testament and the New, and supremely in Christ. Secondly, let's look at Jewish worship. Now, Samaritan worship wasn't even worship in truth. Jewish worship was worship in truth, but not in spirit. As Jesus says in verse 22, we Jews worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. When God revealed himself, he revealed himself in the setting of a family. It was when men had forgotten about the true God that one day, as we've been thinking these last couple of weeks, God spoke to that man Abraham, and he said, Abraham, I want you to leave your father's home and the false gods that men worship there, and I want you to come out and follow me. And he gave him this promise. He said, through you and through your descendants, all the families of the world are going to be blessed. And so he chose this one man. And after him, his family. And that family grew into a nation. And God did great things for that nation. He rescued them. He delivered them from slavery in Egypt. He gave them his law. He showed them things about himself. He built up within them traditions of understanding who he was. Finally, he gave to them an expectation that one day there would be one who would come, who would bring this process of revelation to its final conclusion, one to whom the Jews in due course gave the title of Messiah. And so in that sense, salvation is of the Jews. It's in that background that God revealed himself. So they worshipped in truth. And we Christians have to know the God of Israel, because he's our God too. They worshipped in truth, but they didn't worship in spirit. Because Jewish worship was centered on the temple in Jerusalem. What the woman says, verse 20. Our fathers, our Samaritan fathers, worshipped on this mountain. You Jews say that in Jerusalem is the place where men ought to worship. Why Jerusalem? Well, because Jerusalem was where the temple was. And the temple was the place where God covenanted to meet with his people. And therefore, the temple was the place where sacrifice could be offered. And one of the great truths which the Jews learned through their history, as they learned to worship in truth, was that sinful man can only come into the presence of holy God through the offering of sacrifice. We're defiled, like that woman. There are secret sins that we try to hide. Perhaps we trust that we're not like her, having had five husbands, and the one we now have isn't the right one, and so on. But there are these secret sins. And therefore, if man is to draw near to God, it must be by the way of sacrifice. And the temple was the place where sacrifice was offered. Do realize that in the synagogues, sacrifice wasn't offered. Synagogues were simply places for meeting, for hearing the law read and expounded. But if you wanted to draw near to God, you had to go to Jerusalem. And the worship that was offered there was very much mechanical and outward. It meant going through outward forms. It didn't really involve the worshipper in his heart and soul very intimately and personally. Indeed, the individual worshipper was left on the outside. Only the priests went into the Holy of Holies, and only the priests went into the holy place, and only the high priest went into the Holy of Holies, and he only once a year, and then only with the blood of a sacrifice. And all this signified that there wasn't really a way into the presence of God for his people. Only an outward form and show and symbol. So it was mechanical, outward. It wasn't worship in spirit, in which the true worshipper draws near to God, not just by going through various outward motions, but by communion of heart and soul and spirit. He worships God in the realm of the Spirit. So there was the Jewish worship. Worship in truth, but not in spirit. Finally, Christ points us forward to the inauguration of Christian worship. Verse 23. The hour is coming, and now is, when the true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. And again, verse 21, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. So Jesus says we're just on the verge of a tremendous happening. Jerusalem itself and the temple is going to be made obsolete. No longer will men be tied down, if they want to meet with God, to any place, whether it be this mountain or whether it be the temple at Jerusalem. The way is going to be open for all men to come in the realm of the Spirit. Not just to come outwardly and physically, entering a building, but in the realm of the Spirit to draw near to God. What's going to make the change? Why is the temple going to be done away? Well, I hope that I've given you enough clues to guess the answer. Man can only enter the presence of God through the offering of sacrifice. And Christ has come into the world to offer the one sacrifice for sins forever that will truly take away sins and will make all offering of subsequent sacrifice obsolete, unnecessary. It's going to be abolished and done away. Jerusalem, the temple, it signifies nothing anymore. And so he says, the hour is coming. It's even on us now. The hour has come in the person of Christ, who is that one to whom the Jews look forward and who's arrived to fulfill and do properly all that the Old Testament sacrifices could never do except in outward form and shadow, pointing forward to what Christ was to do when he was to come. And so here is full Christian worship. Worship in spirit and in truth. And who offers Christian worship? Where is it offered? Christian worship isn't offered simply by being present at a Christian service. To offer Christian worship, you have to be a Christian. You have to have availed yourself of the cleansing from sin that comes from Christ's sacrifice. so that you, personally, individually, can draw near to God first in truth, knowing who He is, the way He has revealed Himself in Christ, but not only in truth, in spirit also. You're not offering Christian worship just by being physically present in one of these buildings that we call a Christian church. You offer Christian worship in the inner shrine of your heart and soul and spirit. And therefore, that we may offer such worship and realize that there is the way of access for us, Christ leaves to us this sign that we're going to observe this morning, the sign of His Last Supper, that tells us His body was broken, His blood was shed for you, so that even you, here and now today, in this place, can draw near unto God. Let's claim our inheritance and renew our understanding of it as we join together in the Creed.